Three messages before we get started. I have a brand new sponsor, Scott Walker, the entrepreneur's lawyer. Frankly, I'm not even sure why he's paying to sponsor Mixergy, since Scott Walker is a pretty well-known lawyer in the startup community. You probably already know him from his Ask the Attorney posts on VentureBeat, or from Venture Hacks, or from QuickSprout. Scott is the guy you turn to when you're raising money from VCs or selling your business, but if you're launching, he'll also help you get your company structured properly. So check out walkercorporatelaw.com. PickClick is a company launched by my buddy Ryan Sitt. He is the guy who Craigslist banned when he created a visual way to search that site. But Ryan is a fighter man, so he launched a new site, PickClick, which is a visual way to search eBay, Etsy, and other sites. PickClick is less than 2 years old and already it's profitable. Way to go, Ryan. He's already generating $1 million in product sales per month. Go check out what he's doing at pickclick.com. And my third sponsor is 99designs, the largest crowdsourced design site. If you hire one designer to create your logo or your website or any other design, you'll get just a few ideas from one person. But if you go to 99designs.com, you're going to get flooded with tons of custom designs from tons of different designers all over the world. And best of all, you only pay for the work that's best for you. 99designs.com, I use them and I love them. Frankly, I go to 99designs just to be inspired by the beauty of the work that's on there. Check out 99designs.com. Here's your program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. You guys know what we do here. Every day I invite a different entrepreneur who built an interesting internet company to come on and talk about how he built the company or how she grew it. And I love hearing those stories because they're motivating, because there's a lot of inspiration and ideas behind them. And I also want to learn from them how they built their businesses so my audience can go out there and create incredible companies and hopefully come back here and let me interview them. Today's guest is Andrew Mason, founder of, wow, I've been looking forward to this interview for a long time, Andrew. Founder of Groupon.com, the group buying site that launched in 2008, became profitable in 2009, reached a reported $1.35 billion. That's over $1 billion valuation in 2010. And my goal for this interview is to hear the story of how he built that business, to get some advice from Andrew for other entrepreneurs, and to find out if it's true that he really can bench 350 pounds the way he said earlier in the pre-interview. Is that, let's start off with the most important number. 350 pounds, can you bench press it or not?
Well, underwater.
Don't lie to my audience, my friend. Is that tested or is that just the number you're tossing out there?
Underwater, no question.
All right, okay.
Yeah, overwater, it's over 80 pounds.
All right, somebody please add that to his Crunchbase profile. He can underwater bench press 350 pounds. How about this other number? Is it true that you're doing over 100 million, or that you're set this year to do over $100 million in sales?
That's not even that much. But yes, I'll say yes. We don't talk about numbers, but that one, sure.
It's considerably over that, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, wow. You don't strike me as an entrepreneur. I went back and I looked at your old blog posts and your old video. What they say about things online not dying is true. I saw a video of you for 3.5 minutes doing a recap of Desperate Housewives from the night before, years ago. I saw you as a political activist trying to get people to support a cause.
Did you see my yoga video?
No, I didn't click on that. But I did see your Second Life video where somebody was standing and having a conversation with you, and like a character on Second Life, you were walking around them. What I'm trying to say is that, were you always an entrepreneur? Where does this entrepreneurial thing come from?
I still don't really consider myself an entrepreneur in the sense that I think I've never been driven to create a huge company and make a lot of money or run my own business, or none of those things have been motivations of mine. I think I've always just been motivated to be working on interesting things. It turns out running a company gives you an opportunity to do a lot of interesting things, so it's a fulfilling outlet for that desire.
For example, what have you been able to do since the company has done well that you couldn't do before?
I hired somebody to walk around the perimeter of our office for 5 days for 8 hours a day, wearing a tutu and not talking to anyone or looking at anyone.
Can I see that person on camera?
They're not here anymore. They were limping by the end.
I see. Seriously, what have you been able to do that you weren't able to do before? What's the best part of this?
I think the best part of it is the opportunity to build a company in the image of the way you've always wanted. It's like every day you're dealing with companies as a consumer and compiling a list of frustrations. You know, your idea is like, if only I was in charge. I mean, even going back further than that to like dealing with your teachers when you're a kid. And saying, if only I was in charge, this is what I would do. And now having the opportunity to actually be, to see if I can actually do any better. And in a lot of ways, I think I'm quite proud of what we've done with Groupon in terms of the customer experience, in terms of the type of culture that we're building here. And we're trying to prove the fact, I mean, we're certainly not the only company that's ever proved it, but that you can... You can have fun, you can have integrity, you can do things that are in the long-term best interest for your company, your customers, at the same time.
Can you give me an example? How have you been able to do that?
So one example would be we have a completely open return policy. If anyone ever feels like Groupon let them down after having used a Groupon, we'll give them a refund, no questions asked. And ultimately, the philosophy there is we try and treat our customers like they're adults instead of having policies that are designed to control the 0.1% of people who would naturally take advantage of those things. Because ultimately, the benefits of that kind of trust are greater than the costs that 1.1% are going to impose on your business. And it's worked really well for us. We find that people live up to the challenge when you give them freedom.
When you give a refund, does that come out of your wallet? Does that come out of your account? Or it does?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, let's go back to how we got here, to this company where when I said over $100 million, you said, oh yeah, that's low. The first business that I think I saw you start was Policy Tree. Is that right?
Yeah, it wasn't really a business at that point. So I'm from Chicago. Where are you guys? Where are you
actually
based
today? I'm in Buenos Aires, but I live in California.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. So in Chicago, I think it's a different type of culture for the most part, is what you see in Silicon Valley, where we're not growing up or when we get into business, just the entrepreneurial dream. I mean, it's alive, but it's not as it's not in the water the way it is there. So I didn't, when I first started building websites, I didn't know about the concept of venture capital. I didn't know about angel funding or the entire concept that somebody would give you money in exchange for equity on the promise that it would turn into a lot of money someday. It was completely foreign to me until it actually happened. So I just built websites because I had ideas that I was compelled to fulfill, and I got lucky that I started working as a developer for someone who went on to be my investor and co-founder in Groupon, and just kind of said, that seems like a good idea, why don't you drop out of school and turn it into a company. So
this is the founder of Inner Workings?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's the company that you worked for before you launched your site.
Right, exactly.
What did you do there?
Developer.
Okay. And when you took your idea to, who was it at Inner Workings that you took it to?
His name's Eric Lefkowski. He also runs a kind of an investment company, incubator kind of thing here in Chicago called LightBank. But I didn't actually even take it to him. I got to know him through working there, and I told someone else about it, and they told him about it. He called me up in between classes one day and, you know, asked me to pitch it to him, and then told me, he kind of laid out, like, here's how it works, you know? You keep going to school, or you can work on this idea, we'll fund it, and you can be entrepreneurial. So it was through no ambition of my own that any of this ended up happening.
What was the idea that you talked to him about? What did it sound like back then?
So the original idea was, it turned into a website called The Point, and it was a much broader version of what Groupon is today. It was a platform for groups of people to come together and say, I'll do something, but only if enough other people do it with me. It could be used for raising money for a political campaign or for some kind of charitable cause. It could be used for a collective action thing, like organizing a boycott or organizing an event of some sort. But trying to solve the problem, the problems associated with getting a group of people, a problem that is too big for one person to solve alone, that requires the commitment of a group of people, and everybody not being willing to take that step because they don't think there's enough other people along with them. And one of the ways that it had been used was, or that it was being used, was for collective buying. And ultimately, when we decided it was time to figure out how to make money with this thing,
Can we hold off on getting into the collective buying? Because I want to dig in deeper to what happened up until now. For the transcribers, mm-hmm. the name of the company is The Point, and it was thepoint.com. And this was 06. I read in TechCrunch that you got $2.5 million in angel funding. Was that accurate?
No, $1 million in angel funding.
It was $1 million. So you just took this idea where you're going to bring together a collection of people who won't do anything until they all agree to do it. That's what you took to Eric over at Inner Workings, and that's what he said. I like this idea so much, I'm going to give you $1 million. I'm going to invest $1 million in this idea.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, we had a working relationship, and so it wasn't like it was just me coming blind to him with an idea and, you know, an outline or a business
right.
plan. And so I think a lot of it was just we'd worked together before.
You worked for years with him. How many years?
Up to that point, I think maybe a year.
Oh, it was
now,
just, oh, I see, okay. From 2006 to 2006 is how long you'd worked with him.
2007.
So $1 million is a lot of money for an angel round, and it's a lot of money for just an idea. Why so much?
I wouldn't do it that way if I knew what I was doing, and I could do it again. So let me not try and justify it.
Okay. Why do you think he gave so much?
Because it's good to have you can make an argument that it's good to have freedom to be able to work on the things that you think are important and not be constrained by capital. But you can also make the other argument, which actually became true in retrospect, which is that having too much money, it's good to have some constraints. We spent $4,500 on tarot cards, a deck of tarot cards explaining the point that we distributed at the Netroots Nation conference. Like, what a stupid way to spend money.
How else did you spend money that if you had constraints you wouldn't have? Or what kind of decisions did you make that you shouldn't have made or wouldn't have made if you had the constraints of lack of funding?
Time to market. That was the biggest one. So we took between January and November, really, of 2007 to get everything just right and make sure that it aligned with my complete vision of what I wanted this platform to be, instead of just getting something to market quickly and letting users tell you if it works or not. And that's the biggest lesson that I learned as part of that project. And the result of learning that lesson is demonstrated through the creation of Groupon, where we went from idea to actual launch product
in about a month.
Yeah.
Okay.
Given it was largely built on top of Groupon, or I'm sorry, on top of The Point, but still, it was the first version was not pretty. But
you
it
got
was
the
enough
suits walking around behind you, by the way.
Yeah. No idea who those guys are.
Okay, interesting. So I'm going to come back to what you launched in that month when you launched Groupon, but let's stay with this. So he's investing $1 million in the business. You called him your partner, I think, or co-founder. What was the split at the time?
They took the majority of it. So for me, it was him and his partner, Brad Keywell. For me, the calculus was more like I've never really been motivated by making a lot of money as much as I am just by working on interesting projects. And this was the opportunity to work on something interesting and do it in the right way. So for me, things like split just didn't make much of a difference. I think this is a way in which I'm probably not a good example. Not someone that anyone should try and take lessons from.
We learn from everywhere. So yeah. Was it 30 Eric, 30 Brad, 30 you? Is that basically what we're talking about? One third?
It was something where they got the majority. I don't want to go into the specifics of how it is. But.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. And the idea was to cover, as you said, lots of different topics. I read when you launched and a comment on somebody's blog about your launch. You said, "We have an idea for revenue up our sleeves, but we're not ready to reveal it," essentially is what you said. What
was for the point?
Yes, when you launched the point, somebody said, "There's no revenue model in this thing. They're going to fail." And you said, "Well, hang on a second. We have something up our sleeve. We're not ready to talk about it. We'll come out with it later." What do you think the revenue model would be?
Well, Groupon was the revenue model. I mean,
so you knew it would be this?
No, I don't want to. So we had three ideas for a revenue model. One would be advertising. If somebody's running a campaign against about a problem they're having with a specific airline, it's an advertising opportunity for other airlines to want to get their message out there. The second was taking a piece of fundraising. And
was
the third,
doing, I'm sorry, there's a little take, noise in the background. Can you say it louder?
Sorry, it was taking a piece of the fundraising that we were doing, 5% or 10% or something like that for the charitable fundraising. And the third was collective buying, which we knew from the beginning there was a strong application here. But we didn't know exactly how it would be executed. So the idea was to get it out there, get people using it, and then figure out the revenue model later, I guess.
Okay, so it was letting people raise money for charitable organizations and you take 5% of it. There was advertising, which is traditional. Most of us know what it is. And then the third one was some idea of crowd buying, where people can all get together and buy, but you didn't have it fleshed out. Here's what I saw on the website. You're trying to get one. Here's some of the campaigns I saw on the website. Trying to get 1 million people to commit to not clicking on CNN's dopey stories. And if a million people commit to that, then those million people will not be clicking on the dopey stories on CNN. 211 people clicked on that.
Right.
I saw a jacket for Andrew Mason's friend Matt. Not enough people were willing to raise money for it. Basically, what I saw was a lot of the campaigns just didn't get any traction. It was big goals and very little activity. What was going on inside the company when that happened?
I think it was thinking about focus and thinking about how do we take whatever community we have, or how do we solve this chicken and egg problem, right? How do you have enough people looking at these things that these huge things can become successful? And ultimately, Groupon, part of the design of Groupon was meant to solve that problem. Instead of leaving, I mean, there's two things that were going on exemplified in the campaigns that you mentioned. I mean, a lot of things, but another is just when it's completely user sourced, your experience in terms of consistent quality is going to be inconsistent. So if you're looking at 10 campaigns that people have put up there, some of them are just going to seem ridiculous and it will sour your experience. So with Groupon, it was like, let's take the creation, let's not just add a collective buying tab to the point and allow people to source these campaigns on collective buying campaigns on their own, because there will be quality issues, people won't be thinking about what's necessary. Instead, let's be in charge ourselves of curating and handpicking these campaigns, have a different one, but only one every day. So our very small community will still be large enough that if we channel it all into this one thing, we'll be able to achieve the critical mass that we need in order to make it a success.
I see.
And so focus, it's like Groupon is just all about super focus.
I see. And how did you get that? It wasn't a huge community, but it was enough of a community that if you focused it all on an offer, it would be pretty powerful. How did you get that big community?
Well, that's part of why we went local, because it became possible to go around to the people in our office building for starters. And we kicked it off with just 500 people that we got signed up on our mailing list. And I think an important thing, most of our business we do through an email list. And it's important, I think, to think about your marketing strategy as part of the actual model of your business. And email was part of that from the very beginning, driving people to this email list. So it's not something where they just show up one day and they say, that's not for me, and then they never come back again. It's better to get them to look at it five times, and chances will be much higher that they're going to find something they like. And email makes it possible to do that when you're actually pushing something out to people.
I see. Okay. And it seems like even from the beginning, the marketing was baked into the product. Even the point, the idea was, once you establish a campaign, you have an incentive to tell your friends about it. And if the campaign doesn't get activated unless a certain number of people hit, then you have an incentive to tell strangers about it and bring them into the campaign. So whose idea was that? And how did you come up with that? How did that idea come about?
That was my idea. It started with, actually, the first thing was getting a cell phone cancellation termination fee, and feeling like, man, that's not very fair. And
that's what? I'm sorry?
It's not very fair. And people, I've been a customer for this company for 5 years, and they're hitting me with a $200 cancellation fee because it doesn't fall on an annual anniversary. And not only do I not think it's fair, but I've heard everybody that this has ever happened to bitch about this problem. So there should be a way for us to all come together and say, we refuse to pay this fee. Like, ultimately, your ability to enforce a rule is only as strong as your subject's willingness to be subject to it. And if you can organize the subjects, then they basically have power. So that's where the original use case was. And then it was just a process of saying, wait, you can use that same model. And then, by the way, I had that idea, and then I went back to school for public policy. And there's a lot of taking classes in collective action, and realized that this is a much more pervasive problem, these collective action problems, where you have one person that feels like they can't get something done, even though the collective preference would be for change. So it seemed to make sense for a platform, an internet platform, to exist to aggregate those preferences and help them cross the bridge into actual action.
Beyond the issue of an inconsistent set of campaigns that people can join, why else do you think the idea behind the point didn't work?
Well, look at the example. I think the point should have been a book. And Groupon should have been the website. You know, the point is much more of an idea, and it's so abstract. You know, I mean, even the way I described it, it's like, you could use it for this, and you can use it for that, and you can use it for this. It's like, what is it? People need to be able to go to a website and within a second and a half understand exactly what it is. Even when you look at Groupon, the collective buying element of it, we've worked to almost hide that to the people who are having their first experience. It's something that's progressively disclosed, mostly only once you've made the purchase. So when you go to Groupon, it's like, you know, there's something I want and it's for half off. That's the primary message. And then we kind of work the rest of it in. So I think the abstraction was a big problem as well.
I see. So there was an element of campaigning and protesting in there. There was an element of raising money for charities. There was an element of raising money for a pancake maker for the office in there. There was a Kickstarter idea in there where if you had a project that you needed money for, you can raise it there. There was coupons. Mm-hmm. I see. It was too much. If you would have focused on maybe one and expanded that until it grew to its natural size, then maybe you could have added others and others on top of it.
Right, exactly. And that's what Groupon was. It's taking one very specific application of the idea of the point and doing it really well. Like what we found as we were working on Groupon, we had this big platform, is every campaign that somebody wanted to do that was kind of this, what part of a different vertical, would have a different set of needs to really, product needs, meaning like in order to really make this work, you need to have like a certain feature. And we couldn't really deliver an excellent experience for any individual application of the point. What we ended up doing was delivering a mediocre experience for everyone. Kickstarter is actually a great example of a site that took the fundamental idea of the point. I don't know if they were inspired by it or not. I don't really care, but they took the fundamental idea, which is raise money for a minimum, and they took a very narrow application of it and did an excellent job executing against it. So it's like the point kind of is the idea from which both Groupon and Kickstarter, or that's the book and these are the websites.
I see. Okay, right. And if that's the book and the big idea, somebody listening to us might be able to apply it towards other ideas too.
Yeah, I think there's definitely still an opportunity to take it and apply it towards activism in particular. The problem is, another problem is, like, take the Comcast example that inspired the whole project. And a lot of the examples that got me most excited, like the idea of building a dome over the city of Chicago, which is something that if you had a way to go to everyone in Chicago and say, what would it be worth to you to make the winners here obsolete? People would say, like, I don't know, $10,000, like everyone would. And before you knew it, you would have billions and billions of dollars for this project. That's not really activism, but anyway, whether it's that or whether it's there's somebody can do it if you can overcome the scale.
Interesting. I see a lot of people copying Groupon almost exactly. I wonder if they're missing a bigger opportunity to copy the original idea and take it in a different direction. So I'll get to the copycat soon too, at the end if we have time. So I mentioned the CNN. We won't click on the crappy links on CNN. I saw a fundraiser for studio lease. I saw get $10 off of $25 value concert tickets on the site. So lots of different things. Very few actually Groupon-like activities on the point. Mm-hmm. But I think the original description of it was when you launched Groupon, it was the public, the users are using the point to share deals with each other, and so we have to create this side project. But I don't see that big a bubbling for it, that big a demand for it on the point. Is that just right. The PR story, the way of explaining why Groupon came out of the point, or was it?
Right. No. I don't think it was something where it was like we felt, oh my God, there's so much happening here. It can the point community is no longer big enough to hold it. It was more like we saw examples of it. It seemed like a compelling, interesting way to take it. So we launched it as a side project. Like there are definitely examples on there of people trying to get a group discount on a bicycle or a magazine subscription and stuff like that. But ultimately, it's not like we couldn't have taken it in a different direction. It's just the most interesting thing to explore.
I see. Okay. Why did you decide to launch it as a subdomain of the point? It was Groupon.thepoint.com, I think, in the early press releases.
Because we didn't have Groupon.com. We had to buy that later on. So it's actually a good story.
Tell me.
Sure. Okay, so we launched. We had the idea. We got it going. The guy that actually writes all the content here had the idea for the name, and it was like the perfect name. And we emailed the people that own it. And said, "Hey, you interested in selling?" They said no. We said fine because at that point we had no idea where this was going. And then we went and worked on the project. We got some momentum, and a couple months in, we mailed them again. And we said, "Hey, are you interested in selling?" And he said, no, definitely not. I said, just curious, what are you planning on doing with it? And he said, well, I live in England somewhere, and I'm interested in, at some point, starting a group coupon service where somebody would be able to buy a coupon that if they bring four people into a restaurant, you know, all five of those people would get a discount. So it's like a slightly different take on the group buying, group coupon model. And we said, that's interesting, you know, we're doing something somewhat similar to that in the United States, so maybe we could work together on this. You could help take this thing to Europe. And we said, no way. And we said, okay. But so we continued operating, and then we had a trademark for Groupon, and that trademark extended to England. And so we contacted them and said, hey, you know, you can launch that thing, but you can't use the name Groupon because we have a trademark on it. And so then we started to became willing to sell. So I think we bought it in May of 2009 or something like that for maybe $250,000, which seemed like a lot at the time, but now seems cheap.
Wow, so he had the domain first. He came up with the name first, but because you trademarked it first, you had maybe not a way of taking it from him, but you had more leverage than you would have otherwise.
You're right, I think so. I think he didn't have anything going. I mean,
he didn't have what? I'm sorry?
He didn't have anything going on it. There was nothing on the actual site. I think he just had an idea for something that he could do someday.
I see. Okay. And what about the
risk? He's a good guy.
Sorry?
He's a good guy, though.
And he ended up probably making more money than if he would have launched the idea he had. Why launch a business when you don't own the domain? Wasn't that a risk?
We were using getyourgroupon.com, and then we bought up all the Groupon, like Groupon Chicago, Groupon Boston, bought up all those domains. So yeah, it was definitely a risk.
Okay.
But we just figured it's a good enough name that we'll figure out how to do it without the domain.
Okay.
People do that all the time, right? I mean, Foursquare, I think, did it. Dropbox did it. Facebook did it.
That's right. It was the Facebook. It was getdropbox.com. It's risky, but you're right, it's done often. You mentioned earlier that it took just 1 month to launch Groupon.
Hmm?
What was that first version like? What did it look like?
So the campaigns that you could start on the point all had little flash widgets that you could embed in other websites. So all we did was we took a WordPress blog and we skinned it to say Groupon. And then every day we would do a new post with a widget from the point embedded. I mean, it was totally ghetto. We would sell T-shirts on the first version of Groupon, and we'd say in the write-up, you know, that this T-shirt will come in the color red, and it will be the size large. If you want a different color or if you want a different size, email it to us. You know, we didn't even have like a form to add that stuff because we were just. It was so kind of cobbled together, but it was enough to prove the concept and show that it was something that people really liked. The actual coupon generation that we were doing was all in a FileMaker app that I built, and we would run a script that would email the coupon PDFs to people using just Apple Mail. So, like, I remember it got to the point where we'd sell 500 sushi coupons in a day. Ends up crashing the computer because it was trying to send 500 open send 500 PDFs to different people at the same time. So definitely, I mean, really the first until July of the first year was just scrambling to we had a tiger by the tail and just trying to catch up with the demand and build a reasonably piece together product.
I see the influence, by the way, of Woot. I read in your blog post announcing Groupon that you're influenced by Woot, and I can see it in the way you guys write your descriptions of the products, and that comes right down to the first product that you sold. So you said, for the transcribers, you said Apple Mail. That's what was going on. You had a script on a Mac that used Apple Mail to email people their coupons. Wow. So why did it take off like that? Why do you think it did so well?
Because, and we didn't realize the extent to which it solves it did what it did until we actually bought the salt in. But it seems
to
be.
Can you get a little closer to the computer? Sure. There's just so much noise behind you. I want to make sure to hear you clearly.
Sure.
Can you tell the whole office to please quiet down? The founder is talking. The head muckety muck people. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Why does it work? So, we seem to have found a way to make e-commerce work for local businesses online. And more than that, we seem to have found a way that's to deliver effective marketing results for brick-and-mortar businesses that's completely unprecedented, both online and offline.
But why in that beginning? What were you doing so well that attracted customers? It's harder to get customers to come in and sign up and pay than it is to get somebody to sign a petition against CNN. But they did come, and they came in large numbers right from the beginning. Why?
So with business owners, I think critical, especially at the beginning, was finding a way to take all the risk out of being featured on the board. So typically when a small business owner is doing marketing or advertising their business, you write a $10,000 check, you hand it over to the newspaper company, they put an ad, you hope that that exposure turns into leads, which turns into customers. With Groupon, the feature is free. You're only paying when a customer comes in the door in front of a discount or commission. So, and then on top of that, you only have to participate if we reach the number of buyers that makes it worth your while. So while we often blow through that minimum number at this point, it's almost irrelevant a lot of times. In the beginning, it was essential to getting people warmed up to the idea. So because of that, we were able to attract great businesses really from the very beginning, and they've progressively gotten better. But at the beginning, definitely things that people liked and wanted to use. And by having an email list, again, it comes back to baking the marketing strategy into your product. By having that email list, we were able to basically beat down on our customers every day. So even if we sucked one day, you know, we could suck the next day and we could suck the third day, but on the fourth day, we might deliver something awesome, and then we got them as a customer. It's not like it was with the point where somebody will check it out. If they don't see something that they like, they're gone forever. We get a lot of tries.
So on that original landing page, I would see the offer, and if I didn't like it, I'd walk away, right? How would you get my email address to present another offer to me the following day?
So the first thing we try and do when we're driving people to the site is get them to sign up for the mailing list. I mean, the way we explain the value proposition to customers is have an email delivered to you every day with an awesome deal. That's what Groupon is, more than it is about the specific deal that you see that day.
So even from the beginning, in order to see a deal, I'd have to sign up for the mailing list?
Yeah, you can see the deal without signing up for the mailing list, but the first thing we try to do is get people to sign up.
I see, okay. All right, so the deal was maybe an example of what's to come by email, and the service is introduced as an email service.
Yeah.
What about virality? What were the first things that you did to have the deal spread virally?
So having the minimum was useful for sure. We see whenever a deal hasn't hit its minimum, virality is always higher than the ones it has. But the kick to having stuff. To having stuff that people share socially is to have content that's inherently social. And Groupon is kind of sitting at the intersection of e-commerce, local, and social, because all the things that were featured, that's why I think the name social commerce makes so much sense, is because the stuff that we're featuring is inherently social. It's stuff you do with other people, going out to a restaurant, or going to see a movie, or going to the theater. You don't do it by yourself, so you have to share it.
I see. Okay. Who called up the sponsors or the merchants at first, and what was that experience like when you were calling them up?
We started off with a team of about 7 people. We had a couple business development guys, as well as the guy that was also doing the writing. I mean, you know, even I was doing it to some extent early on. We were all calling the businesses, and I mean, it's similar to how it is today. We've gotten more refined and efficient at doing it, but it's still figuring out how to explain this new concept to people. And the best way to describe it is if we can get a ton of new customers in your store, will you give us a great price? And that basic idea is something that most small business owners can wrap their heads around.
Can you tell me a little bit more about why you started out by going local? If you would have gone for a national product, like maybe Steak by Mail or maybe software that's available online that has high margins that anyone around the country or around the world could use, you would have had a broader audience, but you went specifically for Chicago at first. Why?
I think that I looked a lot at Mercata when I was thinking about I looked a lot at the way that group buying happened during the first dot-com boom when I was thinking about how we want to approach.
Ah, Mercata, the site that was backed by Paul Allen.
Yeah, exactly. So what it is it's kind of like Amazon, where you're selling, you have a marketplace of consumer goods, cameras, televisions, computers, that sort of thing. Only there's group buying involved. So the more that people buy, the lower the price goes, and it failed for the best reasons in the world. So basically the problem was that companies like Amazon and Walmart were already so big and already had so much leverage that they could still negotiate better prices than Mercata could, even when you had 1,000 people signing on to buy a TV. So with Groupon, it's like, how do we avoid all those problems? Well, first of all, let's make it one deal a day so that instead of distributing our collective buying power across an entire marketplace of products, it's all funneled into one. And second, instead of going after these consumer goods, these national products that you can buy anywhere and have already had all the margin squeezed out of them by these huge companies with a ton of leverage, let's go find truly unique things from local businesses where maybe they've never done a discount before, maybe they've done no marketing whatsoever before, and the margins are larger as well, so we can offer a deal that's truly unique. So it just seemed like a way to really help get collective buying power to work at a small scale, right? Again, it comes back to maybe the collective buying model works for consumer goods, but you would need to have a community as big or larger than Amazon's in order to achieve something like that.
I see.
But for local, you can make it happen while being much smaller.
Okay. Do you have some examples of mistakes that you made at Groupon? It looks like it's just hit. And everything seems to have worked out.
You know, I'm sure there are tons. I'm sure we're making some right now, maybe in the background, or maybe on the camera. But a lot of the it's hard to tell because we've had so much success that I think the mistakes all seem small, but they may start to show themselves over time as the market matures. You know, we now have everybody's eyes on us and everybody trying to figure out how to do what we do. So I think the opportunity to make mistakes and to fail is more like in front of us than it is behind us.
When you hire 200 people in a few months, essentially, how do you keep the culture alive? How do you maintain the culture that you started with and keep one that you can grow with?
I think you have to invest in it. And the danger going through for a company like ours is that everybody's just riding high off of the success that we're having. And success is kind of like an aesthetic for problems that might be deep-seated problems with culture. So I hope we don't have any of those, but there's no way to really know because everybody's doped out. So I think we're just trying to over-invest in culture. We're getting we're instituting good training programs that make sure that before people walk in the door, they understand what we're about. In that first week, they're just completely submerged in it. And it's just, you know, our values are a constant part of the decision-making progress that everybody goes through.
I've written down here in my notes, email over and over and over. You send out a daily email every weekday. How do you keep from burning out the list?
By having awesome content, I think.
Sorry, can you get a little closer? It looks like it's getting a little louder behind you.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I think it's by having awesome content. We have a team of about 65 writers who are producing the equivalent of a 200-page book every day. And for every one of those write-ups, probably there's six different people that touch it before the public actually sees it. And we've taken a lot of time to find really, it's been painful and terrible in order to make sure that we maintain our standards there, because it's really easy to just say, okay, let's stop making these write-ups interesting. But I think it's critical to keep people engaged so that people will be interested and enjoy reading about the business that they have no interest in actually buying.
I see. What about the churn? What's the churn on the mailing list?
I'm gonna print out the resume.
It's relatively low, not to go into specific numbers, but we're pleased with it.
What about the size of the list?
It's about 10 million.
10 million unique people around the world were signed up to Groupon in their local cities.
Right.
Do you have a national or an international version the way that Daily Candy does?
We don't.
No, it's all local.
Yes.
I read recently that when you launch in some cities, you have offers that aren't really valid yet. Basically, it sounds like a minimum viable product, right? Can you talk about that?
Offers that aren't valid yet? What are you talking about?
What were you going to address? We'll go with that.
I was going to talk about this TechCrunch article.
Yeah, that's what I got emailed to me. The one with the new CEO of the company talking about how when you launch in foreign city. Actually, why don't you take it? I don't want to get it wrong, and I'd much rather have you get it right.
The new CEO of the company. Are you talking about our president?
President.
Our COO?
Excuse me. Yeah. CEO.
Yeah. Right.
Sorry.
Oh yes. So what happened? That's actually a great example of a mistake. That's the first bad press that I feel like we certainly deserved.
That you did deserve, you say?
Yeah, we totally deserved it. And what happened is there's a company that we acquired in Brazil where they were posting deals that were example deals, basically, from fictitious companies in cities where they hadn't launched as a way. I mean, I don't even know what the intent was exactly. It was just a bad decision by somebody in the company that we didn't know was happening. And I think we're now, it was kind of a kick in the pants to get more organized and make sure that we understand those things better. And people thought it was super misleading. They're totally right. So the only thing we can do is learn from the mistake and make sure that something like
that. You're saying they're totally right.
Yeah, it was totally shady.
All right, fair enough. So I had it, I didn't have the details right, but I get your point. It seemed to me like it was somebody testing a minimum viable product, putting up a bunch of offers, seeing if we'll get enough tests on, if we'll get enough uptake on them, and if we do, then we launch wherever we get the uptake.
No, you're giving it way too much credit.
I am.
It was nothing, it was just fake businesses, fake deals. I mean, no one could buy them, so it really doesn't do anyone any damage, but it's still totally misleading. It makes it seem like there's all kinds of activity going on, when in fact we hadn't even launched in that city. So anyone just giving it a casual glance would come out would be misled. We're kind of growing and learning very fast in the spotlight, and I think we have to be very careful to make sure that speed doesn't come at the expense of quality. In that case, it did.
How involved are you in the day-to-day operations?
Pretty involved, yeah. I mean, that's what I do. I guess there's more stuff like this where I'm being the pretty face at this point. But
now, you mentioned something about actually when I interviewed SeatGeek, the whole idea behind the business is they were going to help you figure out when is the perfect time to buy a seat to a concert or to a sporting event. And they had these charts that they were going to present to users, and it was terrific, and it was accurate, and it was powerful, but nobody understood it. So even though it was their main reason for being, they kept minimizing it and just highlighting the fact that you can get cheap tickets to events. Seems like the same thing happened here. Can you explain how you de-emphasized the collecting buying power and how you understood that you needed to de-emphasize it?
I think we understood it just by knowing intuitively that especially after our experience with the point that any level of complexity that trying to take too many steps at the same at once in terms of exposing people to new ideas is predestined to fail. And it's one thing to say this is the way it should be, people should be able to figure this out, people should invest in it, but it's just not realistic. So it's always been a mantra of ours to keep things as simple as possible.
Our viewer in Vancouver is saying, why did Groupon buy a fake company? How I'm not excited about the way he phrased that, but what kind of screening do you do before you buy companies to make sure that they're legitimate, to make sure that the numbers that they give you are? You're buying lots of companies quickly here.
I mean, not lots. We've really bought, well.
How many?
In terms of for international expansion, there's been three, one of which wasn't really launched yet. But it starts with meeting the people and being sure that there's a cultural fit and that the people are the types of people that we think will be able to lead the company in the growth. Then it's also looking at the numbers and making sure that they align with our numbers, that we're seeing, that we think that they're doing a good job. And then we also talk to the customers that have been using the service, and we talk to the merchants. And in every case, all that stuff is checked out. There's nothing about it that's a fake company. They're posting fake deals in cities where they haven't launched, and that's, like I said, not good. But it doesn't actually impact the people in the cities where they actually are launched, who are having great experiences.
Daniel Licht in the audience is asking, why doesn't Groupon have an internet quote city so that users can enjoy a product that is shipped to them versus a local product?
There are people that do that really well already.
Okay.
So we're focused on local.
What do you think of the competitors that are out there? What are they doing right? What are they doing wrong?
Don't really talk about competitors too much. We're really focused on trying to make our product awesome for consumers rather than worrying about what other people are doing.
What about the search engines that are aggregating sites, including Groupon, like the one that I think Matt Coffin is backing?
We think that people need to understand. One thing about these competitors is a lot of them are kind of people who are quickly getting into this, see an opportunity to make money, and then 3 months later realize it's not going anywhere and drop out. And these aggregators are pulling together all these sites of different levels of levels of credibility. So I think kind of buyer beware. If you're going to start buying from all these other sites, just be aware that most of them won't be here in 6 months. So beyond that, I think stay tuned for some things that we have coming up in the product.
What do you mean? More products per city or?
No, you stay tuned.
Okay. All right. Any What do you think about the idea that the issue that there are a lot of products for women? I see nail salon and spas.
That's true. I think our product mix has just evolved to reflect the people that are using the site. We run what tends to do well. We also have paintball and sporting events and things for guys. But we're thinking about what we can do to make sure that people, I mean, people don't have completely strange experiences where they get a guy gets a deal to learn how to pole dance and then he goes and actually learns it and gets to fight with his girlfriend or whatever.
How do you prevent fraud?
What kind of fraud?
Coupon fraud. People saying, "Hey, I didn't get a copy of this coupon. Can somebody give me a? I didn't get this coupon. Can somebody give me a copy of it? Can I fake the coupon somehow?"
Oh, they all have unique numbers on them, and a business has a list, and they check it off. So we don't see a ton of fraud.
Oh wow,
that's an issue for us.
What kind of advertising are you doing?
We do advertising on, you know, a lot of Facebook advertising, a lot of Google advertising. So it's helped us basically amplify our rate of growth.
To do what? To fire up?
Amplify our rate of growth. We rely on it heavily when we're going into a new market. People don't know about Groupon and we want to get the list built. And then over the coming months, the majority of our customer acquisition comes with it.
I saw that here in Buenos Aires. I've been seeing a lot of ads for Groupon Buenos Aires. I said, I didn't even realize that they're here. I click over.
Yeah.
The first thing that I saw was enter your email address. I hesitated for a minute. Then I said, I know Groupon. I'm about to interview the guy. I'll give my email address. I still haven't gotten any emails, but I do check the site from time to time to see if there's anything local that I can go explore.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys own that? Do you guys build that from scratch or is that an acquisition?
That's an acquisition.
Here, I've got a question here from someone who says, allow him to talk about G-Bucks, the new Groupon loyalty program. That's from Willie F. I saw that on your blog recently. How does
that
work, and what are you finding so far?
So what we were trying to do is create almost like a local rewards program, a local version of a airline miles program, where people can earn points, or what we call G's, for everything they do on Groupon, from checking the deal each day to buying the deal or sharing the deal. And then you can take these and you can redeem them on a local marketplace, basically, of gift certificates to businesses that become cheaper as you earn more G's. So what we thought would be cool was to have a rewards program, but almost like the American Express rewards program, but instead of earning money for, instead of being able to spend your money on consumer electronics like what you have on the American Express store, you can spend it on local experiences.
Let's see what else I've got here. Advertising viral, big mistake. We talked about that. All right. When you raise money, did you get to cash out? Did you get to take some money off the table personally?
Yes.
How's that impacted your life?
I kind of, you know, the day after I drove home and I was like, what should I spend money on? Like, I was like, where can I turn left or turn right and go, like, buy something? And then I couldn't think of anything and then life went on. So, I mean, it hasn't really.
It hasn't changed your life at all, but did you really look around and say, all right, now I finally have the ability to go and buy something outrageous, or I have the ability to go and buy something to let me realize that this is real?
Yeah, and I couldn't think of anything, really. I mean, not at all. I bought a piano.
You did?
But, yeah. But other than that, I mean, for me, money is much more, I think, about freedom than almost just like mental knowing that you can do, you can do whatever you want, and it really helps. It's good. I think it's good for the business in the sense that it allows me to. You don't have to think about how do I get money out of this thing. Like, that's kind of behind me. I can focus on what's in the long term best interest for Groupon, our employees, our customers, and our merchant partners.
Have you been able to, as you're spending so much time on work and so much, and there's so much going on with Groupon, to get political? Everything that I've seen before Groupon seems to show that you want to take a stand, that you have opinions, that you want to help other people express their activism.
No, I mean, Groupon is pretty much all consuming, but I think, you know, there'll be opportunities for those things further down. But I think interestingly, while like the point, for example, we started largely inspired by achieving those kinds of outcomes, the really great thing about Groupon is we found that it's done a better job at doing social good than the point ever achieved. We're finding that people are using it to get out of the house, get off the computers, and live life. And people are getting closer to their husbands and wives. I mean, we get crazy emails that feel like they're written by a PR company or something from our customers about how, you know, their marriage was on the end of, was at its end, and then Groupon came along and started going out more, and now they're happier than ever. Wow. So all that stuff, I mean, we're affecting people's lives in real ways, and we find that quite fulfilling. So it's not, I don't feel the need to go off and get involved in politics.
All right, let's take one last question from the audience, from Ben Fremmer, and then one for me, and that's it. Ben is asking about patents. Do you have any patents on the Groupon system that's going to allow you to prevent copycats?
We have a patent pending on it, but that's all at this point.
Okay. What about any advice for guys like Ben who are out there building new businesses?
The only thing I can figure out that I've done right is just always focus on doing things that are interesting. And, I think the best lesson that I've learned, people always talk about the importance of failure. And I think there's truth to that, but largely what it is, and for me, I consider my failure what happened with the point. Just went a year treading water with that. It's knowing that failure is a possibility. I think a lot of young entrepreneurs are people who have had success after success after success, and they assume that whatever they build will turn out well. And that's certainly the way that I was. It was like if you build it, they will come kind of attitude. But when we started Groupon, from the beginning, I had this paranoia. And since then, I've kept a list that I look at every week of what are the biggest problems of the business, what are the ways that we fail. And it sounds almost fatalistic, but it really frames my way of thinking. I found it to be useful and has helped us focus on the right things and anticipate problems instead of waiting for them to happen. So knowing that no matter how great you are, you too can fail.
All right, well, let's leave it there. Knowing how great we are, we too can fail, and we did, actually. We ran into trouble here in the beginning setting up the Skype call. I'm glad we stuck it out. And Andrew, great to meet you, and thanks for doing this interview.
Likewise. I hope it was useful.
Cool. It absolutely was. And guys, thanks for watching. I'm Andrew Warner. I'll see you on the website.